and welcome to the Partners in FinCrime podcast in association with FSCom. My name's Evan McGugan.
And I'm Chris Vaughan.
In this podcast series, we'll be looking to discuss all things anti-financial crime.
We'll be deep diving into cutting-edge stories, as well as other interesting topics in the financial crime space. In this episode, we talk about financial sanctions, in particular OFSI's report on wise payments and the FCA's review of good and poor practice.
Hey Chris, how's it going?
Hi Evan, doing well my friend, how are you?
Yeah, not too bad, thanks, not too bad. How's life with you? Any crack?
You know, as we always start these things off, nothing massive to update you on, I suppose. Been keeping one eye on the rugby, which has been very interesting for the old Ireland. I think we mentioned that a few weeks ago. They seem to be doing very well. It's all good. Football's going all right, but not for the mighty Leeds. We're not maybe doing as well as we should be, which is a bit annoying. But that's all right.
I was going to say, I can only hope the next time we're recording the podcast, we'll be doing a special episode talking about Ireland's march to glory in the rugby. But looking forward to potentially seeing you next week, Chris, as well, in person.
Indeed, you're making the journey over, aren't you?
Indeed. So hopefully, to tie it back to our other favourite topic, the weather, this London October heatwave stays from my arrival.
Yep, come and join me on the banks of the Thames. I can have a little sunbathe.
So yeah, we've got a guest joining us for this episode. James Nurse. How are you, James?
Yeah, very good. Thank you. Thanks for having me. You know, also been keeping tabs on the rugby, although I certainly don't expect England to be kind of going to glory next time I tune into one of your podcasts.
But yeah, stranger things have happened, but I think equally quite unlikely. Good. Well, I dare say there will be a bit of a crossover between listeners of this podcast and people that are maybe aware of yourself and FinTrail. But before we jump into the topic of the day, would you maybe like to introduce yourself to the audience? Maybe tell us a little bit about who you are and what you and FinTrail do.
Yeah, sure. So I lead the consultancy team at FinTrail. So all the usual consultancy services predominantly focus on, you know, financial crime related pieces, all very similar to what our friends at FSCom will be doing as well. We also run something called the FinTech FinCrime Exchange at FinTrail as well. So I guess it's a community of fintechs globally that we set up around 7 years ago. So, you know, that's me in a nutshell. But before being in consulting, done a few first line and second line roles, the usual journey that I'm sure everyone's been on before, but really pleased to be here today.
Good. And when was it? When did we first meet? Was it 2018, 2019 in one of those previous first line roles? Feels like a long time ago now.
Well, I think maybe you were an auditor for me in one of my old roles, and then obviously we then reconvened when I probably pitched to do an audit for you. Yep. And rightly so, you probably didn't pick us at the time. So it's small world, obviously.
Okay. Nice one. So lovely to have you on today anyway. Thanks for joining.
Yeah, welcome, James.
Thanks, Chris.
Good. So I guess, you know, what are we going to be covering this time? It sort of feels to me that it's possibly been a while since we've talked about sanctions. Obviously, you know, a key focus for firms, even more so probably than it was previous, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago, prior to the Russian invasion of Ukraine, which itself is sort of hard to believe it's been going as long as it has now. I think we're coming up to 2 years anniversary in a few weeks. But on that, with Wise themselves having recently sort of found themselves in the crosshairs for OFSI for the provision of financial services to a designated target, or at least an entity that was owned or controlled by a designated target, and the FCA having quite recently released the outputs of their assessment into the sanction systems and controls of regulated FS firms, I think it might be a prescient sort of time to jump into that topic, jump back into that topic, so to speak. What do you guys think?
Yeah, definitely. Super interesting, especially seeing as it was the first time they use some of the disclosure enforcement powers as well. Mm. So, you know, super interesting to see, I guess, a more proactive approach to, I guess, our sanctions regime than the reactive one we're probably all used to seeing from a more broader fines perspective.
Absolutely agreed. And definitely some lessons to be learned as well from an operational and firms perspective. So plenty of us to, or plenty for us to sink our teeth into anyway. We'll maybe start with Wise then, if that makes sense. And if you'll indulge me, I'll maybe very quickly set the scene as to what happened there, and then maybe we can have a bit of an open discussion as to you know, what this means for the MLRO, what this means for senior management and compliance functions across the UK and elsewhere. So on that basis, I guess the crux of this one really, and I wrote down the date here, but on the 31st of August 2023, Ofsi essentially released, as you say, Ian's disclosure notice against Wise Payments Limited for breaching the Russia sanctions regulations 2019. Wise Payments Limited, obviously the artist formerly known as TransferWise, a UK registered company regulated by the FCA, sort of provides financial services to consumers, but also businesses. So money remittance, FX, all that good stuff, cards, e-money as well. The judgment essentially went in this case that at the end of June of 2022, so what is that, 4 or 5 months after the initial invasion by Russia, a £250 cash withdrawal was made from a Wise business account held by a company that was owned or controlled at that time by a designated person. So somebody Ofsi had listed as a sanctions target. That cash withdrawal was undertaken using a debit card held in the name of the customer, so the corporate entity itself. And at that time, that company, you know, it was an active customer of Wise or a customer of Wise anyway. In this instance, the designated person, so the person who was subject to the financial sanctions listing, became a prohibited individual essentially on the 29th of June 2022. So this breach happens on the 30th of June 2022, and they were sort of listed, for want of a better word, the previous day. The report, the disclosure notice, goes into a fair bit of detail on the nuts and bolts of the breach. But in essence, to sort of summarize before we jump into things, at this point in time, it was Wise's policy to screen company names for sanctions exposure, screen for directors and UBO significant controllers for sanctions exposure too. So in this instance, they would have been screening for the company name and all those associated people. If they identified a potential match, they would suspend that customer account, and that would essentially prevent the customer from sending or receiving any funds to or from that account. However, and this is where it gets interesting, if that customer, so that corporate entity, had a debit card, as they did in this case, Wise's policy essentially at that time was not to suspend the use of that debit card as part of that initial investigation or suspension process. So that customer, that corporate customer, they were still able to use that debit card despite the fact that the entity may be controlled by a designated person. And that's essentially what happens. So I guess we'll talk maybe as well about the FCA report in a bit. It talks about good practice, bad practice and so on. But this is probably quite a relevant case study that maybe we can sort of jump into. What's your sort of snap judgment here, gents? What do you think? Good summary? What would you like to pull out?
I think it's interesting that ultimately there's the gap almost in the control in what the actual system breach didn't exist. It was a process breach ultimately, which I think is probably the most interesting part in the sense that there was no concerns with the system. It picked it up effectively. It was just a lag in how they actually kind of reviewed the alert and actioned the alert ultimately. And obviously, if it related to one of their other kind of, you know, products or services that they offer, so, you know, money transfer or anything like that, they probably would have picked it up as part of other screening mechanisms. But ultimately, because it related to a debit card or a card that associated the account, it was ultimately, you know, missed through that process. So I think from a message perspective, it just, you know, shows the importance of understanding how, you know, not just sanctions controls, but obviously in this case, sanction controls, they connect across your different products and services you offer as well. It's not just this is how it works for one thing and it worked for everything. It's just considering the kind of, you know, the bigger picture there as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one important thing to consider as well is individual assessments per the products and services that you have. So as you say, James, you should have an interconnected understanding of risk across products and services. But I believe that probably this card product was launched somewhere down the line after, you know, Wise had already been in business, because this wasn't like their primary product, you know, their primary offering. So at that point, there should have been a risk assessment that would have looked at not just financial crime concerns, as we think about them in terms of AML and terrorist financing, but also sanctions as well. You know, you have to look at that. What is the potential exposure of this product? And as you said, James, how does that interlink with the other products? Can those other products then cause you to have a potential gap over here? And again, it's about that. It's about that suspension piece. That it's not that the firm didn't have an alert by the looks of it. It's that the product itself wasn't suspended automatically, which allowed funds to be made available to the designated person. And that, of course, is the breach there. So, yeah, I think that's really sort of interesting. But it's about the separate pieces as well as the wider picture, if you see what I mean.
No, it's definitely a good point. I think you're right to say, yeah. So the point at which really they really fell foul of the sanctions regime was, yeah, when they made those funds available to the entity that was owned or controlled by a designated person, in this case, that company. I think the timelines too on this are quite tight. So I think, James, to your point, like the system, like everything worked. And to your point, Chris, as well, everything worked as it sort of should have, or at least that it was designed to do. You know, they got their sanctioned alerts at like 11 in the morning, I think, on the 29th, got alerted to it by midnight. Like 4 o'clock or something the next day, they did the rescreening. At that point in time, Wise had, you know, automated systems in place to, you know, suspend the account because an alert was there that hadn't quite been dispositioned. And it was just a matter of 2 or 3 hours later that cash withdrawal happened. So that wider sort of point on making sure that, yeah, that product set is well set up to not be utilized by a bad actor, or at least somebody who you wouldn't be wanting to necessarily service at that point in time. Making sure you have that visibility on how that should work is fairly critical. I think I was reading too, and we all sort of know about it as well, but one of the rationales that Wise gave for this was, you know, false positives, very high false positive rates as well. I think I saw a mention of like 99.999% false positives, at least in their experience when it comes to sanctions alerts. And in hindsight, and we'd all agree as compliance consultants and compliance professionals that sanctions, you know, it's extreme risk, low likelihood, but extreme risk if something goes wrong. And maybe on the face of it, it seemed from a Wise perspective that, you know, not to suspend the card at that point in time would be reasonable because of the high false positive rate. It really just reiterates that whole point that you really have to take sanctions very seriously. And, you know, if OFSI comes knocking or you have to self-report, any sort of operational justification is unlikely to hold too much water.
And I think, I mean, what's interesting with this one is just reflecting back on the nature of the new powers that got introduced for OFSI is that this is the way in which because obviously it's not a fine, that's the important kind of piece to recognize. And OFSI ultimately like determined it's like less severe and severe breaches. And obviously for this particular one, they identified and addressed this as a less severe breach, which ultimately they deemed it did not warrant any kind of enforcement from a fine perspective or anything like that. And ultimately they used the disclosure powers to, I guess, name and shame in the way, it, probably to educate the industry, which is ultimately what this particular disclosure process was created for in the first place.
Yeah, I don't know if you mentioned it at the beginning as well, Evan, but it was just £250. So, you know, it's, as you say, it's quite a low value amount, all things taken into account. But nonetheless, that probably does also factor into the severity of the breach as well.
Agreed. I think also probably too, I think the disclosure notice itself talks about the low monetary value, as you say, but also like self-reporting. their cooperation as well in that, and the fact that this couldn't happen again. So like when Ofsi had come in, they had already put those remedial measures in place, that corrective action, to mean that automated car blocking and weekend, like weekend work came into this too. They maybe didn't have weekend coverage for the sanction team, but all that sort of stuff had been remediated and resolved as part of, you know, Wise's approach to what they had put in place after this happened. So a few sort of corroborating factors that really goes to sort of put pay to the fact that, well, you know, you never really want Ofsi or OFAC or anybody else coming knocking, but if you identify something, report it, cooperate, and make sure you sort of learn from it. But it is good. It's good to see those new powers being used, as you say, really great case studies to try and learn from. I'm sort of surprised there hasn't been more, but maybe there's more coming. I don't know.
No one's reporting.
I think that's an important point about disclosure, though, and understanding what your obligations are. So first of all, to Ofsi itself, obviously, to report, and then also in terms of principles to the FCA for underprint 11. So obviously being transparent and communicating with the FCA matters, you know, which should reasonably come under their purview and you'd want to make them aware of. So those two particular sort of reporting lines is yes, okay, so that the risk incident has occurred and has manifested, you would want to go back and look at root cause and understand what you could have done better. But at least you took the correct steps once it had happened, because obviously you can't turn back time. But the best thing then is obviously not to, you know, to just hope it goes away, but it's to take those steps, to be transparent, to do a root cause analysis, and then take steps afterwards to remediate any loopholes or gaps that you had.
And that dual reporting one's quite important as well. Some people forget that you're obviously obligated to report to Ofsi in certain circumstances, but the FCA or obviously you know, whoever else you're supervised by, depending on your industry, is wanting probably to know as part of your other reporting mechanisms as well.
Absolutely.
Do either of you have much of a view on, so I guess, you know, one of the reasons why the card blocking wasn't in place was because of false positives and, you know, operation, you know, but it wasn't just purely because of the operational headache of having to deal with that, but also not wanting to inconvenience customers. Do either of you have a view on like what is good practice or best practice in managing that? Particularly, you know, we've had Consumer Duty come in the UK quite recently. So do either of you have a view on how to sort of balance, you know, that requirement to, well, not provide funds to designated persons, manage work streams and workflows, but at the same time, you know, keep the consumer at the heart of everything?
It's tricky, isn't it? Because if you ask me about any other, I guess, threat or, you know, compliance with, you know, the money laundering regime or anything like that, it'd be slightly different. And obviously, we talk about being risk-based in our decision and how we implement our sanctions program. The guidance talks about it, obviously talks about it as well. But ultimately, to a certain degree, being risk-based does not necessarily marry itself to certain types of, you know, how you implement your sanctions regime anyway. Like, yes, you can be, you know, risk-based in terms of, I don't know, the list that you screen against and things like that and certain other aspects. But, you know, ultimately, there's the margins for being risk-based kind of tighten slightly with when we're talking from sanctions perspective. So it becomes a little bit more tricky.
Yeah, definitely. And particularly with products and services that allow you to get hold of funds quite easily, like a card product, you know, that's as simple as going to an ATM to make funds available to yourself. There's no lag time in terms of the, you know, we've screened this, it needs to be immediate. There's really no lag time. It's not like it's illiquid and it would take a while for the customer to then be able to get hold of the funds, in which the firm can then potentially act or freeze funds, etc. It needs to be very quick. So again, that comes into the product risk assessment, doesn't it? It's sort of, it's really all part and parcel of what you're actually offering and understanding the fund flows and even the time frames in which customers can get funds out of a particular product.
Agreed. And I think that time frame one's a good point to sort of touch on again. But yeah, the lack of an automated control in addition to the lack of weekend work sort of contributed together to this manifesting. So maybe something for firms to have a think about. But I'm sort of going to stray away now, but like when you think about fraudsters and how they usually operate outside of business hours, always good to have a think about how time, i.e. like the 24-hour clock, like how that sort of feeds into things, what your coverage is, what your operational coverage is, be that your human-led controls or your automated controls outside of business hours, outside of when you're going to have an analyst sitting at the desk. And what happens if something flags when, you know, maybe somebody isn't looking at their email inbox or something like that?
I was going to say, you'd think maybe a lot larger firms with a more exposure, maybe such as Wise, might have more of a, you know, 24-hour follow the sun kind of coverage, and particularly at weekends. You know, I appreciate its proportionality, but when you're dealing with such large amount of transactions, you wonder whether that itself is, you know, a gap.
Great. So anything else you guys do think would be useful for us to discuss around this case? Any closing words from either of you?
I think the other thing you touched upon actually was that evidencing that they have remediated it. Like, I think that's like a really like important part, which is, you know, obviously they were quick to report and they were quick to remediate the issue. Obviously this relates to any kind of, you know, breaches or enforcement or whatever, or risks or issues. You know, if you're going in front of, you know, the regulator or whoever, or your banking partners, being able to demonstrate that you've proactively remediated it already is super important. Like, just turning up in the room saying, we've got this breach, but we've done nothing about it is no good. So you need to obviously actually be able to demonstrate that you've actually tried to remedy it, which you obviously mentioned as well, which was a big part of probably the severity of it, the fine as well, or the not fine.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I think that's, like you say, often with anything really, even when, you know, when we do audits, as we all do on firms, when you find a finding, it's really understanding then what the next most practicable steps are, like what could you do next that is best, because look, we can't turn back time, there is a gap, whatever it is, but what is the next most appropriate step that you could take that would reduce this? And it might be a time frame piece as well, like funnily enough to go back to time, but it might be, right, here's a short-term solution that fixes, you know, these parts of the problem. Here's a medium term piece that, you know, over time we need to look at remediating this. And then here's a longer term. This is where we want to get to. It's going to take a bit longer, but at least we've got an understanding around, you know, that we're going from A to Z really in terms of managing a remediation piece. And I think that's important as well in, you know, speaking to actually come in and fixing something that you found has not gone to plan.
That's a good point.
Yeah, the whole incident management piece, shouldn't be forgotten.
Indeed. I wonder if we could maybe touch on the actual the piece that the FCA released around sanctions itself, that had a review of firms and found good practice and bad practice. That might be something we could maybe touch on, because it links into the Wise case, I think, and you mentioned it at the beginning, Evan. So I wonder if you've got some thoughts. Maybe you could set the scene if you fancy that.
Yeah, so I guess that does dovetail quite nicely with what we were just discussing. As you say, the FCA very recently released a report into their assessment of the sanctions compliance systems and controls that firms have implemented to ensure that they have effective sanctions risk mitigation frameworks. Basically, the FCA went out and assessed in and around 90 firms that they supervise across, you know, a large range of different sectors that fall into their regulatory perimeter. The report itself, if anybody's interested in reading it, and it is definitely well worth a read, was released at the start of September, if I remember. So good to have a look at it. It sets out examples of good practice, but also areas of poor practice along a few separate sort of key themes. So a lot for people to read into and maybe consider what goes on at their firms and whether or not they can potentially learn from those thematic review points. It basically looks at how firms have reacted to the Russia-Ukraine situation. I think that's the reason they went and did it. And there was some mention of using an analytics tool. They had, I don't know if either of you saw this, I wasn't really sure exactly what they were referring to, but some type of analytics tool to do outreach and get some information and data, but also they engage with firms, you know, one-to-one and through specific intelligence and follow-ups and so on. So quite an interesting one to learn about some good practice and bad practice over the past maybe 18 months. I know, James, you've definitely done a bit of reading on this. So I don't know if you'd maybe like to kick things off here and sort of jump in a wee bit.
Sure. I mean, well, they ultimately did it over a course of, you know, 18 months or 12 to 18 months. I think it was like 90 firms that they looked at. And I think you mentioned analytics tool. I'm not 100% sure how sophisticated the analytics tool was that they implemented, but certainly a list of such was provided to each individual firm, probably similar to as, you know, we use and you use in terms of our testing and sampling for all of our audits that we do. And obviously that fed into some of the results as well. I don't know where you want to start, but I think we could maybe spend probably 30 seconds talking about the positives and probably half an hour talking about the negatives, because I think there was only three positives or pros or positive feedback points that they raised. And then I think there was about, I don't know, 9 or 10 kind of constructive feedback, I guess, for firms that they identified along the way. So I don't know where you guys want to start, pros, cons, or...
Let's maybe start off. Or should we start off with the good?
Start with the good. Chris, do you want to start with the good, or do you want me to cover a couple?
Yeah, feel free to jump into it, and then we can go back and forth on it maybe.
Sure. All right. I mean, probably there was three particular ones that they basically highlighted. Probably the one that I found the most interesting is about the proactive approach. So I think, as you mentioned, with the Ukraine war at the moment, basically they determined that the businesses that took a more proactive approach to reviewing and stress testing their kind of sanctions programs were in a much better state. So this principle of doing, I guess, red team exercises, and I think it's definitely an interesting one to continue to follow. Obviously, the geopolitical situation in China and at the moment with Taipei is a bit tricky. So you know, hopefully it doesn't come to a similar kind of position that we're in with in Ukraine. But clearly, if the worst was to happen, we would certainly expect to see a large amount of regime kind of be populated. So I think going back to that point, though, is ultimately they mentioned that people that were well prepared and did testing and from that perspective were in a much better position than people that maybe had just implemented their program and kind of just left it where it was, basically. But other things they mentioned were, you know, tool collaboration, so the usual bits. They identified some businesses that had good tool collaboration for name variations, reasonably bland as a point, to be quite frank with you, like and simple. And then I think there were just some other bits on, I'm just having a reread now out of it, on general screening systems. So okay, I'm just, it's basically, they were able to articulate it. So this is actually quite an important one. So they basically mentioned that some firms that that understood how their systems work were easily able to articulate how it works and what happened and you know, what the output was, what the input, and which is obviously accounted to maybe with some of the cons or the constructive feedback that they had on some of the others, which we'll probably come on to now, I'm guessing, which is where they some firms were not able to articulate how their systems work. So which is not such a good state to be in when the FCA are doing some kind of thematic review on whatever control area may be.
Yeah, definitely. I think there's two points that actually apply, not just to sanctions there. Both of the ones that you mentioned there, James, actually, like the first of all, readiness and horizon scanning. That's not obviously just something that applies to sanctions. We would want our compliance teams to be proactively horizon scanning across the board, you know, basically all opportunities for things like this. And I think that readiness piece is really important. But then also, yes, understanding if you are, and in most cases, people are partnering with third parties to, you know, for sanction screening purposes. Do you as a firm understand what that tool is doing? Because if you don't, then how can you possibly demonstrate that you are managing the risks, because you're not sure what the tool's actually doing and what it's designed to do? And that, again, doesn't just apply to sanction screening, but applies to all sorts of places across the AML framework where you may, that's the AML and sanctions framework, where you may be using a third party provider. TM jumps right to the forefront of your mind, doesn't it, in terms of what is your TM provider doing? Are you able to actually design it so it's appropriate for your products and services and your customers, et cetera, et cetera. So I think all of these things are very important for sanctions, but do have a wider application and make sense in that wider context as well. Evan, do you want to touch on some of the negatives maybe?
Yeah, absolutely. So as you would expect, a few of the negatives are obviously the exact opposite of the good practice that they call out to your guys' point. You know, going and having a screening system, but maybe not exactly understanding how it works, like update speeds on lists, also what lists you're even screening against, you know, going in and, you know, we've got Comply Advantage, for example, we screen against the default lists, we should be covered. The FCA specifically calls out firms being overly reliant on third-party tools, not understanding how these tools works, not calibrating them as well to the risks that they face as being a real issue. Something I find quite interesting, and it is something you see doing audits, but even also generally across the industry, is an over-focus. Now, granted, this is an FCA report, but they call out an over-focus on OFAC and US sanctions regimes. And we all know why that is. OFAC obviously being particularly extraterritorial, and you know, you certainly don't want to fall foul of US sanctions regimes. But the FCA report, they call out the fact that, number one, firms may have, whilst being overly reliant on these third-party tools, not really checked that these tools screen against the off-sea lists. A lot of global firms who maybe have UK operations were said to be not aligned to UK sanctions regimes as well, with an over-focus on US sanctions. And they are going to be pretty similar, you know, in reality, but there is differences between those regimes. So I thought that was a very specific, an interesting specific twist to the way that it was presented in the report. I hark back to when it all kicked off, and I was actually still in industry at the time, and one of the horizon scanning activities we undertook was, well, luckily we didn't have much exposure to Russia and Belarus, so we sort of got ourselves in the position to be able to suspend and make those prohibited countries, and we did that ahead of time, which then made it actually quite easy, you know, once the war kicked off and the sanctions went in. But one of the other things that we did was make sure that we were fully up to date, you know, with our ongoing KYC, with knowing who actually owns and controls companies, making sure that was all accurate. They're like, there's no backlogs in PRs or EDRs, but also that it was all in the system. And one of the things the FCA calls out is lack of resourcing. Yeah, always calling that out. It's obviously a problem, but they call out lack of resourcing, which then led to backlogs in KYC, CDD checks, and then leading to sort of inadequate checks being completed. And I think that's an interesting one to remember too. If you've got a backlog in periodic reviews, and you know, to your point, Chris, earlier as well, when we were talking about having a plan to remediate something, if you have a backlog, say, you know, we'll get through it in 6 or 9 months' time, you know, if we get this resource in, so on and so forth, and then all of a sudden China invades Taipei, and then there's these sanctions, and now all of a sudden you've pretty roundly, you know, made economic resource available to a designated person or a company controlled by that external macro factor, can very quickly land yourself in a difficult situation. So I find that quite an interesting thing to sort of think about as well.
Yeah, 100%. I think those are important. One thing that I wanted to pick out, I don't know if you have comments as well, James, I'd be really interested to know your thoughts, but one thing I wanted to pick out specifically was around the governance piece as well. So ensuring that senior management at a firm are not just necessarily delegating this to their compliance firms to be experts on, but lead from the top and have a good in-depth understanding in their own right of what the sanctions regime looks like and their obligations under it. That, I suppose, links into things like training. It links into, obviously, sort of senior management functions, SMF roles. It links into MI, ensuring that MI from your compliance team is well conveyed up to senior management, and they're not just receiving that MI, but are able to digest it, understand it, have a clear picture of what is going on at the firm, and that they're informed enough in their own right that they can actually know what good is, you know, what good looks like and what they're supposed to be doing, I suppose. So I think that is super important as well, and maybe is something as I mentioned earlier, that isn't just sanctions applicable, but is more broadly applicable as well across financial crime, whether it's AML, or otherwise. Sorry, James, I was going to ask if you had any thoughts there as well.
I think you summarized it pretty well, but I mean, yeah, just that I agree. I mean, I think in the contingency planning bit, they also talk about, you know, having appropriate risk assessments, which ultimately should be, you know, signed off by senior management. And I think some of the firms that, you know, performed the best were the ones that had a well-documented risk assessment, that the business understood their inherent risks, and obviously we were able to adapt more quickly to some of the circumstances that arose, because ultimately, you know, they understood their risks and where they kind of were exposed to. So, but yeah, I mean, I totally agree with that particular bit.
Yeah, it often does come back to risk assessment, doesn't it? We just did an episode recently on risk assessments. It wasn't specifically about sanctions. It was more your Regulation 18 risk assessment for money laundering, terrorist financing and proliferation financing. But still, it's worth a listen, because everything always does begin with the risk assessment. You know, it really is sort of the cornerstone. And I think that's important to pick out as well.
But also done properly, I think, is the key. Like, I know we've probably all been party to some of the requests to withdraw by various firms in terms of programs and stuff, or then from a financial crime perspective. And I think the linking of the risk assessment's always been a common theme with certain firms and stuff. So I think, you know, it's not just about doing a risk assessment, it's also about actually putting the sufficient hours in to do it properly, and actually making sure it links to your actual framework. You can't just do a risk assessment and then completely separately determine how you implement your sanctions program. You know, your risk assessment should be almost dictating to a certain degree what you're doing, and or at least informing it anyway.
Absolutely. Yeah, agreed.
Nice one. So yeah. I think definitely people should maybe go and give this report we read anyway. We'll maybe not spend any more time going through any of the finer detail. We probably could spend a few hours at it. Before we jump off, I'm sort of conscious that we've nearly went the whole podcast without saying the dreaded C word. So, and it's not Chris, but Chris, I see a lot of, obviously a very busy time at the minute in the crypto world, and I see a bit of buzz at the minute with respect to FinProm. What's going on there?
Yeah, you're right. It's been an interesting time for crypto recently, obviously in the UK, particularly with the travel rule coming in and now the new FinProm rules. So, financial promotions. Basically, the FCA have released new rules around how crypto asset firms can promote their products and services, essentially. So there's certain specific rules that come into that. I think there's four approved methods by which firms will be able to do this, but otherwise they are, they're now expected to comply with these rules, and the deadline was the 8th of October. So as at time of recording, that's already passed. So firms are now expected to be compliant, and hot on the heels of that, we've already seen an issuing of warnings from the FCA directly to firms. So not necessarily unprecedented, but it's quite voluminous. There's 146 been released already against crypto firms. So some of those are perhaps lower level, smaller firms that are have been found to be promoting to some degree crypto asset products or services to UK customers. And there's actually a couple of bigger ones as well. So Huobi was one of the ones, and KuCoin as well, which are two of the bigger, more well-known crypto firms. Both of those have also got warnings against them from the FCA. I think it's worth mentioning as well that this is actually extraterritorially applicable. Sorry, just trying to get my mouth around those syllables, which means that anyone, even outside of the UK, who is advertising to UK consumers would actually fall in scope of this. So firms need to be very aware of this, particularly if you're a group, for example, in which you may have one of your entities that has crypto asset, registration somewhere in the EU, for example. It's still applicable to you if you're thinking about promoting your products and services to UK consumers. So I think it's really important to be aware of. And again, it's sort of a developing story still, but it is very, very interesting. And again, it's a bit of a whirlwind time for crypto generally. Yeah, I don't know if you guys have got any thoughts there, really.
I mean, never a dull day, is it?
It never is, is it? It never is.
What are the interesting side effects of it, though, and I'll not, you know, pretend to be an expert when it comes to FinProm, is a lot of exchanges who are sort of well known for not being registered to provide services in the UK, setting up UK domains specifically to not fall foul of the FinProm rules, despite not being registered for AML purposes in the UK. So all sounds a bit muddy to me. Plenty for people to be working away on.
Yeah, certainly is. Yeah. There's never a shortage in the crypto world of new stuff coming, as you know. But yeah, it's an interesting one, I suppose. Don't know if there's anything else specifically to mention around that, apart from, yeah, that there's these 146. Don't recommend necessarily reading all of them, but it's worth knowing about anyway. And definitely if you are a VASP and you're offering these services, hopefully you're either already very well aware, are compliant, or are working with someone to help become compliant. Because as I say, I think there's only 4 approved methods by which firms can now market to UK consumers, and you need to make sure that you're compliant with one of those. So yeah, cool. All right then. Well, I think that might be us this time round. I don't know if you guys have any sort of closing comments. We've covered a decent bit of ground, I think, and it was actually a really interesting discussion. So any closing thoughts, guys?
Thanks for having me. It's always nice to speak to you both.
It's been a pleasure, James. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been brilliant.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. Lovely to catch up and shoot the proverbial as usual.
Cheers, guys.
Cheers, James.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Partners in FinCrime podcast. If you want to get in touch with the podcast or for more information on governance, risk and compliance related matters, please reach out on our website at fscom.co or, alternatively, send us an email at partnersinfincrime@fscom.co. That's partnersinfincrime@fscom.co.